Hello. We began this course with the statement that civilization was an urban phenomenon. And while this is almost always true, as with any generalization, there are always exceptions to the rule. And in this lecture, I want to examine some of those exceptions. Societies that developed sophisticated cultures but did not build cities. And the most notable category of this sort of culture are those that continue to pursue a hunter-gatherer lifestyle long after most other peoples had abandoned it. Homo sapiens as a species evolved about 200,000 years ago, but we've only been farming for about the last 10,000 years. For all the rest of that time, humans subsisted by living a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Or maybe another way to think about this is for over 95% of the time that humans have existed on Earth, we've been hunter-gatherers. So it is, by evolution and genetics, the way that we are biologically adapted to live. Today, though, only a minuscule percentage of humans continue to practice anything that even remotely approaches that style of life. And it's debatable whether there is anybody left who would truly qualify as a pure old-style hunter-gatherer. Maybe the closest that anybody comes today would be some Inuit in the Arctic or some Aborigines who live in the most remote sections of the outback of Australia. But during the period that this course covers, nearly all humans had already switched over from hunter-gathering to farming or pastoralism. But there were still a few societies scattered around the globe that pursued this traditional mode of human existence. Before we look at those specific groups, let me define a little bit better what I mean by hunter-gatherers and what universal characteristics these cultures tend to share. Basically, hunter-gatherers derive their caloric intake by eating non-domesticated plants and non-domesticated animals. So a typical diet would consist of a mixture of nuts, berries, fish, fruits, wild plants, insects, maybe scavenged carcasses, and whatever small wild game, like rabbits or birds, that could be caught with snares or killed using fairly primitive weapons. Hunter-gatherers are almost always nomadic, so they move around after whatever food resource seems to be the most promising at the time. This sort of mobility was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it gave them great flexibility to shift from one area to another in response to changes in the type, availability, or scarcity sometimes of food supplies. But on the other hand, it limited their physical possessions to what could be easily carried by each individual. After all, when you have to carry everything that you own, you will very quickly strip down your personal property to an absolute bare minimum. And the typical sum of earthly possessions of many hunter-gatherers in many different eras and places has been surprisingly constant. And it consists of just some twine or rope or maybe vines, a single cloak or some sort of piece of clothing, a bowl or gourd, and a dual-purpose stick which can be used for digging in the ground and for killing small animals. In terms of social organization, hunter-gatherers typically live in smallish bands of about 10 to 40 individuals who often are related to one another. And generally speaking, these societies are usually more egalitarian than farming or pastoral communities. So they tend to have less pronounced class or hierarchical structures. Interestingly, there also tends to be more equality between men and women in hunter-gatherer groups. And both of those characteristics maybe result from the fact that nearly everybody in such a community has to contribute to nearly all group activities. And that includes even traditionally male things, such as hunting. Incidentally, contrary to an image that many modern people have of early man as the mighty hunter, early humans did a whole lot more gathering than they did hunting. And what did get hunted was usually pretty small. Early man was prey far longer than he was predator. And if you want to get in touch with your true primitive self, rather than going out hunting, it would be much more accurate if you spent, let's say, some time cowering fearfully in a tree and then maybe picking some grubs out of the bark. Many hunter-gatherer bands were also matrilineal, and this means that the women in a group are related by blood, and that various individuals trace their ancestry through their mothers. And to avoid inbreeding, male members of the group often originate from other bands, and they will join just in order to find a mate. That structure also tends to give more social power to women than in typical agricultural or herding communities. And these sort of exchanges to find mates are facilitated by the fact that in many hunter-gatherer societies, there is some designated time of year, often when there is a local abundance of a foodstuff, when a whole bunch of different bands will temporarily come together or join together to form a larger community, before once again they disperse. It should be noted that in some groups, that dynamic is reversed, with the males of a band being related and women being imported from the outside. By the way, wild chimpanzees and bonobos actually live in exactly the same fashion. So they tend to be found foraging about for the same mixture of foods in little mobile groups of 10 to 40 individuals. Once intensive farming and pastoralism had spread around the globe, the hunter-gatherer groups that survive into the historical era tend to be in locations that either are just not well suited for farming, are extremely geographically isolated, or in many cases have both those characteristics. One region that fits both criteria is the northernmost fringe of North America, Europe, and Asia. And up in those frigid, often ice-covered zones, various groups of hunter-gatherers not only managed to survive, but also to develop rich and distinctive cultures. The Inuit and Eskimos of North America are the direct descendants of such peoples, and they evolved an amazing array of strategies and technologies which were adapted specifically to that extreme environment. And often they had to specialize in certain food-gathering activities, such as whale or seal hunting. And they managed to do this without any metal or wood. But even without those things, they could construct weapons and boats that enabled them to hunt for those selected prey animals. And analogous groups existed in the northern Arctic regions of Europe and Asia as well. In Scandinavia, for example, the forerunners of today's Sami were a tribe known as the Feni, and they seem to have inhabited those areas as early as about 2000 BC. And the Feni actually show up in the writings of the Roman author Tacitus, who in his description of Europe highlights the fact that this group does not engage in farming. Tacitus writes, "The Feni live in complete savagery and extreme poverty. They do not possess weapons, horses, or homes. They eat plants, they clothe themselves in skins, they sleep on the ground. Their only tool is arrows, which they tip in bone for lack of iron. Both men and women hunt and share the prey, but they hold that their lifestyle is happier than groaning over a plow or laboring to construct houses." It should be noted that while today the Sami herd reindeer and are famous for that, this practice only seems to have begun about 500 or 600 years ago. And the Feni of Tacitus's era seem to have been true hunter-gatherers. Inhabiting an equally harsh but completely different landscape are a number of long-lasting hunter-gatherer societies who adapted to living in deserts. And of those two whose existence spans the time frame of this course, and whose descendants continue to live traditional lifestyles well into the modern era, are the San, or the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert in Africa, and the Aborigines of Australia. Both of those groups adapted to living in regions with very, very minimal rainfall. And so they developed a wide range of techniques for finding sustenance in such a unpromising environment. The San, who are also known by the names of some of their subunits, just the Kung, were a branch of the far-flung Khoisan people. And they seem to have been present in the Kalahari Desert region at least throughout the historical era. The story of the Aborigines of Australia is even more remarkable, because it appears that they have been living there for 40 to 50,000 years. And that would make their culture perhaps the oldest continuous culture in the entire world. When they first arrived, the landscape of a lot of Australia was more hospitable than it is today. And the first settlers probably lived along the coastline. Later, though, they spread inland, and they occupied drier regions. And that movement intensified with the arrival of Europeans. Aborigines lived in the usual small kin-related groups typical of hunter-gatherers. And many, many different clans and tribal units have been identified. Emblematic of this are the more than 250 spoken languages and about 600 sub-dialects that were once used by all these groups. Regrettably, today, almost all of those languages have fallen out of use and been forever lost. Life for the Aborigines was regulated by a complex series of rituals and initiation ceremonies that individuals would use to mark the transitions from childhood to adulthood to married life and then to the point where they would begin raising children of their own. The Aborigines mainly used stone to make their essential tools, and that could be augmented by wooden and bone implements. And of course, the most famous Aboriginal device of all is the boomerang, which was employed for hunting, and it could bring down a bird or a game animal. And by at least 10,000 years ago, Aborigines were flinging true returning boomerangs, as opposed to the one-way throwing sticks that are found in lots of different cultures. Kind of strangely, the bow and arrow, which almost every civilization around the world used at some point, was not utilized in Australia. Well, except for a small northern region where obviously it was brought in by contact with some islanders. But Aborigines did have barbed spears and darts, which were flung from throwers, and they made use of all sorts of clever techniques to get game. For example, in rivers or kind of swampy regions, they would make these elaborate cone-shaped traps, and these were specially constructed to catch a variety of large and nutritious eel that lived in those regions. Groups who lived in the various parts of Australia conducted a flourishing trade with one another. So when they met, they would barter items that might be scarce or non-existent in one zone for rare goods from another area. And because of that mechanism, certain things such as shells, quartz, pearls, and various animal products have been found hundreds of miles away from any possible point of original origin. The religious beliefs of these people emphasized a sense of continuity from the past into the present. And the ancestors are always very much alive. All Aboriginal groups share a belief or a faith in a category of behaviors, activities, rituals, and times that have to do with the sacred and with the numinous. And there was a perception or a feeling that there were spirits or beings which had existed from the time of creation and which continued to be present in the world. And this whole notion is embodied in a concept that is somewhat often misleadingly translated as the dream time or the dreaming. But it's really about this idea of an ongoing spirituality that infuses the world and which creates a continuity of the past, the present, and the future. And the colorful myths that are told by various groups often describe origin stories of animals or traditions, and so those help to make sense of the world and to connect those living in it with these underlying fundamental forces of nature and the entire universe. An example is the way in which individual clans would be tied to an ancestral animal, which supposedly played some central role in their history, and then also plays a central role in their contemporary rituals and art. The Aborigines have often been held up as a laudatory example of a group who live in balance with nature. And there's a fair amount of truth to that stereotype. Certainly the religious beliefs incorporate a great deal of reverence for nature, the land, and the creatures that live upon it. Australian Aboriginal art is especially well known for having a very unique and inventive aesthetic. For example, the technique of forming pictures from little colored dots, and this is somewhat reminiscent of the canvases of late 19th century pointillist painters. Aborigine artists painted on a variety of surfaces. They painted on rock, sometimes animal skins, bark, and of course on human bodies. And artists would use charcoal as well as primarily red, brown, yellow, and white ochres and clays. And their art depicts scenes from everyday life, such as hunting, but a lot of it also serves as a medium for expressing that rich mythology and spirituality of the Aborigines, and for illustrating some of the key ceremonies and rituals. And sometimes, even for relating their own history or telling stories in a kind of visual form. Rock art was made both by just applying pigments to the rock and sometimes by hammering or abrading the surface of the rock to create engravings. And some of these rock engravings have been found which date to more than 20,000 years ago. And that suggests the antiquity of that artistic tradition. In addition to true hunter-gatherers, like the ones I've been talking about, there are also some interesting non-city-building cultures that are not necessarily hunter-gatherers. And among these, one which is actually genetically related to the Aborigines of Australia is the various peoples of the Pacific Islands, who fall under the general category of Polynesians. They also constitute one of the more remarkable cultures who have perfectly adapted themselves to a specific environment, in this case, Oceania. And the section of the world known as Oceania consists of thousands of little bitty islands which form a huge arc that begins near Southeast Asia, with the islands of the Philippines and Indonesia, then continues past Australia with New Guinea and the New Hebrides, and then stretches far out into the Pacific with the Marshall Islands, Fiji, Samoa, the Society Islands, and the Marquesas. The very northernmost edge of this region is marked by the Hawaiian Islands, and the southernmost by New Zealand, and the easternmost by Easter Island. Between 3000 and 1500 BC, an enterprising, seagoing people that anthropologists have labeled the Austronesians began to spread out from Asia through all of these networks of little islands. And genetic analysis suggests that their point of origin was probably somewhere near modern Taiwan. The earliest distinct culture for which we have clear archaeological evidence is a group that have been labeled the Lapita. And by 1500 BC, they had settled Melanesia, the area just north of Australia. Lapita culture is best known from a distinctive style of pottery that they produced. And so by following and dating finds of these distinctive pots or even pot shards, we can trace their slow progress across the Pacific. And so from Melanesia, they expanded eastward into Western Polynesia, reaching Fiji, Tonga, and Samoa by about 900 BC. The Lapita did not practice true farming, but instead they would just create temporary fields using slash-and-burn agriculture. And then they would place into those fields imported plants, such as yams and breadfruit that they had brought with them. And they were also the ones who introduced some domesticated animals to some of these islands, including chickens and dogs. Although the islands of Western Polynesia are as far as definite evidence of Lapita culture and pottery reaches, their descendants, who had pretty much a similar culture and languages, then set out further across the Pacific into Eastern Polynesia. And those peoples had reached the Cook Islands and Tahiti by about 300 BC. The descendants of those explorers then pushed even more daringly off into the open ocean and eventually reached Easter Island and the Hawaiian Islands by 500 AD. Some scholars argue about these dates forward or backwards a couple centuries, but roughly speaking. And finally, the last of these bold oceanic explorers settled New Zealand in the 13th century, and there they established the roots of Maori culture. The islands that these seafarers settled upon were really not promising zones for intensive agriculture. The only edible indigenous plants were some nuts, and most of the plants which we now stereotypically associate with these regions, things like bananas, coconuts, yams, and breadfruit, all of those were actually imported. And these were volcanic islands, and that means often their soil wasn't very deep, and events like hurricanes could periodically deposit salt water across all of these small islands, which effectively poisoned the dirt. But nevertheless, by combining limited cultivation of some of these imported plants with raising some imported domesticated animals, life was possible. What made it much more than just a marginal existence, though, was the ocean. A lot of these islands were atolls, and so they were surrounded by extensive reefs, which are incredibly rich marine environments, just teeming with all sorts of sea life. And so the inhabitants of these islands obviously became expert fishermen, and they would use nets and hooks and harpoons, and with those they could just pull a huge wealth of seafood from the warm waters. Collectively, we refer to the people who live on these islands as Polynesians, but they did not constitute a single political or social entity. Each island, or sometimes even each part of an island, evolved its own little variant of the core culture, and often this reflected what resources were locally available. They usually developed their own language, or dialect, as well. And so over 1,200 different languages have been identified in Oceania, although they all tend to be fairly closely related linguistically and often are intelligible by other groups. Body decoration and art, such as tattoos, were commonly found among all the various Polynesian subcultures. And some sort of chief or king would typically rule over each island or region of an island, and there was a lot of trade going back and forth between all of them. The key to the spread and success of the Polynesians was their ability as sailors, as well as shipbuilders and navigators. And completely without any technological aids, such as compasses or astrolabes, Polynesian sailors could cross thousands of miles of open ocean and find their way to little tiny islands. And of course, if they missed their goal, they could just head off into an endless expanse of ocean and what amounted to certain death. And further complicating the challenge for at least the original settlers of these islands was the fact that they were coming from Asia and spreading eastward. But all of the main winds and currents in this area move in a westward direction. So you couldn't simply set out in a boat and let the wind and waves take you to new lands. You had to actively struggle against the forces of nature to explore new territory. So how were they able to accomplish these really amazing feats of seafaring? Well, let's start by looking at the boats. The Lapita developed seagoing canoes that used a large sail, and they were able to make use of this big sail because they were equipped with outriggers that stabilized them. And the original form of these canoes was to simply hollow out some logs, and this was good enough to cross those relatively short gaps between islands as far eastward as Samoa. And during this initial phase of expansion, the islands were not spaced too far apart, so that even though the overall distance covered might be a lot, mariners could sort of hop from one island to another, and there really weren't long stretches when they were out of sight of land completely. They would propel their canoes using paddles and with a triangular lateen sail, and this was sort of advanced technology that allowed them to tack into the wind fairly efficiently. Those boats were not large enough, though, to carry the amount of supplies which were needed for the longer voyages among the more widely spaced out islands east of Samoa. So the later Polynesians, who settled eastern Polynesia, devised a new type of canoe. And this was a much bigger craft, which was built of actual planks attached end to end and then bound with coconut fibers and glue. And instead of a hull with an outrigger, these large ocean-going versions had two hulls, which were linked by a platform on which you could actually build some sort of superstructure. And the biggest of these craft were over 100 feet long and could carry large crews and enough cargo to go thousands of miles. And they were steered not by a rudder, but by paddles. And people have made some reconstructed replicas of these sort of ships, and they've proven to be surprisingly stable and effective. The next challenge was navigation. And through a combination of trial and error, orally transmitting accumulated knowledge, and really just lifetime spent in very close proximity to the ocean, Polynesian sailors became master navigators without any sort of advanced technology. The Polynesians learned to use the stars, birds, clouds, currents, even patterns in the waves to guide their vessels. And they could do things like identify land, even when it was out of sight, by all sorts of means, such as just changes in the ocean's swell, variations in wind and current direction, or of course the presence of land birds. Sometimes they could even see over the horizon land masses, which were reflected in the undersides of clouds. And they really cultivated a detailed familiarity with the complex movements of the stars. And so they learned to estimate direction and distance just based on these sort of astronomical observations. In the Marshall Islands, navigators developed charts. And to us, they look like lattices or webs. And these were made by tying together little sticks or sometimes using the ribs of coconut fronds. And they really aren't maps in the conventional Western sense. But instead, what these charts do is they indicate patterns and directions of currents. They also show at least four different types of ocean swells that could be used to guide sailors to particular destinations. Although the Polynesians built no massive cities, they clearly had a successful, rich, and long-lasting culture. And in areas such as seafaring and navigation, their achievements are among the most impressive of any civilization. While I've only focused on a few representative hunter-gatherer societies, there are many others, such as the Ainu of Japan. And in a world in which every year a higher and higher percentage of people are living in cities, cultures such as these demonstrate that you can have complex societies without urbanism. Thank you.